I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Edition of Parallax Views. The Silicon Valley is sometimes portrayed by prominent voices in media and other sectors of our society as courageously pushing us towards a better and more prosperous future through a model of brave creative destruction and unyielding technological innovation. But what if that is only one side of the story? In Bit Tyrants, the political economy of Silicon Valley, economics professor Rob Larson launches a scathing but thoughtful critique of the biggest players in the Silicon Valley world, including Apple, Google, and even Microsoft. For those who view figures like Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and the late Steve Jobs with rose-colored glasses, Rob Larson joins us to disabuse you of your techno-utopian optimism. In this conversation, Rob discusses with us not only his most recent book, the aforementioned Bit Tyrants, the political economy of Silicon Valley, but also his previous effort, Capitalism versus Freedom, the Toll Road to Serfdom, and how it connects to Bit Tyrants. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to the conversation with Rob Larson, author of Bit Tyrants, the political economy of Silicon Valley. Welcome to Parallax Views, Rob Larson. Author of Bit Tyrants, the political economy of Silicon Valley. I love that title, by the way. How are you doing today, Rob?
Thanks, man. Doing good. Thank you, dude.
So I want to talk about this book, which I have a copy right here. Ooh. Bit Tyrants. Very nice. New release. But before we get into that book, I have to talk a little bit about your previous book for Zero Books, Doug Lane, and the rest of that crew. I'm good friends with them. Capitalism versus Freedom, the Toll Road to Serfdom. I think that's a very interesting book because most people say, what? Capitalism versus freedom? I mean, capitalism is freedom. Now, we know better, but.
Yeah. That's just the name alone gets me a lot of interesting mail. Yeah, the book obviously is kind of based on the classics of modern conservative or libertarian economic thought. So if you're a leftist person, your right-wing relatives are going to tell you, like, well, you should really read Fred Hayek's Road to Serfdom. That'll straighten you out. Or maybe Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. These are mid-century books. They're a little old, but these things get recommended by people to this day. If you watch right-wing media, you know, Rush Limbaugh and John Stossel will tell you to pick these things up all the time. So they still have their right-wing currency. And all I did with that book was just look at how they define the system and look at everything that's wrong with their ideas. Kind of their big argument was capitalism is the best economic system because not only does it produce all the goods and services we like, but it gives us so much freedom and liberty. And so it has those two values. And I focused on that second one, that issue of freedom. And what you find out is it's a system of power and tyrannical control over workers. And it's not quite as sunny and lollipops as they suggest.
Well, maybe you could expand on that just briefly, because I keep telling people, I think the left is the actual emancipatory project. I think it's the conservatives and the sort of right-wing, everything should be private types that are more authoritarian. I mean, I look at someone like Murray Rothbard saying we should privatize the police. And I'm like, well, that means that only, you know, really rich people get protection. That sounds like a dystopian authoritarian nightmare.
Indeed, it's exactly right. It's sort of the way they chop it up in their philosophical tradition is, you know, you want more freedom, and capitalism does that because you're free to choose. You know, you go into a store, you're free to choose what emergency virus products to hoard. You're free to choose which career to go into in the post-pandemic dystopia. So you have these abilities to choose within this market framework, and that's supposed to give us more freedom, right? Because you have those different options. Well, if you look at it, though, the way philosophers sort of break this issue down, they often like to split freedom up into what they call positive and negative freedom, or positive and negative liberty. And it's kind of a simple, sort of just basic framework. And I'm not a big philosophy person. I come out of the sciences and then economics, sadly. But I think it's a useful analytical idea. So negative freedom is the one these guys mostly talk about, right? Your freedom from. So it's your ability to live without having outside power centers coercing you and telling you what you have to do. You can do this, you can't do that. So to the extent you're free to make your own decisions, we call that negative freedom, because you don't have some other entity towering over you telling you what to do. Alternatively, there's the other idea of positive freedom or positive rights. Or the idea is we look at your freedom to do different things, right? Are you free to consume some of the healthcare that our society is able to produce for everybody? Are you free to get an apartment since we have a huge number of them? Like, what are you able to do with your choices is what positive freedom looks at. And if you look at these right-wing guys who I base my book on, they're very, very consistent. I look at this a bit in my own book, obviously. They're very consistent in saying, negative freedom's the real one. You don't have government pushing you around. This positive freedom thing, what is that? Like, that's just people saying they have a right to healthcare. That's crazy. That's nuts. So we don't support that. But on the left, we usually say, like, negative freedom is very important. We want positive freedom. And so where I end up landing in the book, in that big first chapter, is I just say, if you look at it from this perspective, capitalism doesn't provide either of these forms of freedom. We all agree, the left and the right, we agree that it doesn't provide positive freedom. Like, you don't have a right to healthcare, for example. But I would make the case that because there's so much power in the system, from Jeff Bezos to Wall Street to the pharmaceutical firms, these guys have power over our lives. And when they decide they're going to quadruple the price of your insulin drug or move a factory out of town and destroy its economy, those are power plays. Like, those affect the lives of thousands of people very seriously. So to me, there's no way you can claim that even negative freedom is meaningfully provided by our mature capitalist system today.
I just wanted to add really quickly, the only thing I would add to that is I always think about how someone like, say, Milton Friedman would come out and say things like, you know, I think he said this privately. I was talking to the progressive radio host Tom Hartman about this on my show a month or so ago. He was saying that Milton Friedman would talk about how it was bad that women got the right to vote. It's odd because we think of these people as being for freedom, but then they'll also sort of say, oh, democracy has been a bad misstep for freedom. Also a Peter Thiel line, democracy and liberty are incompatible. And I think that it shows the sort of authoritarian tendency within the libertarian mindset. Casey, did you want to add something though?
Yeah, just like on a fundamental libertarian level, this understanding of the world that you have two equally free people that enter into a marketplace in capitalism sense, that when their two freedoms, when their two rights conflict, which they always do in some way or another, that's when it all breaks down, you know? And these mutually incongruous interests will always come in conflict with each other. And so the very idea of a libertarian society where you privatize everything just falls apart, because that means only the most powerful can maintain their interests and can defend their rights. And it just becomes a means by which freedom is the freedom and liberty is the freedom to oppress people that are less powerful than you.
Well, freedom is the freedom of the people who own the businesses to say, you have to work
four jobs in order just to survive.
Yeah, indeed. And if you look at how, yeah, the CEOs and the big figures view this, they always say, like, what about my right to start a business and run it the way I want? If I want to tell my workers they're fired if they get pregnant, then that's my right. Like, they always look at it like their freedom is being impinged, like their freedom to rule the economy is being rudely infringed upon. We call that, I talk about that in the book too, we call that hegemonic liberty. You know, like, I should be free to shoot anyone I want and to shoot people out of cannons. How can you take away my freedom? Yeah, but your freedom has crossed the line to hurting other people. Like, now you're violating their negative liberty. So if you're, yeah, using the language of freedom to defend your little corporate fiefdom, yeah, hegemonic freedom, we call that. Yeah, it's pretty phony. What you're saying at the beginning, JG, is very right. You know, libertarians are pretty antagonistic to the republic and to expansions of the franchise, and they don't think much of democracy. Like, you grubby masses, you don't understand the fancy ideas and all of our, you know, complicated, complex businesses of today. You guys are too dumb to cope with it. And they have like a real like full-on elitism about it. And anyway, it varies. Like, libertarianism is like, you know, it's like the left. Like, there's a variety of specific different ways that these various kinds of idiots chop up this issue. But it's interesting. Lately, I've been reading some Ayn Rand because I have no choice. In a week, I'm debating the head of the Ayn Rand Institute on the Pac-Man show.
I do not envy you.
Yeah, I don't envy me. That's your that's a sensible response. But it's like, I talked about her just a little bit in my last book because I wanted to read the serious people, you know, Friedman, Hayek, you know, von Mises, Rothbard, and stuff, because those are the serious intellectuals on the right, such as they are. Ayn Rand, like, I read a little of her work for my last book, and it's like a comic book version of conservatism. Like, all the CEOs are sexy and smart, and their employees are dumb and just serve them. And if you're a union leader or a government regulator, you're like fat and bald and described as being unattractive. It's like how a kid would caricature these ideas. I was like, this is so, I'm not reading this. Like, this is embarrassing. And it's so flimsy and just floppy and just such weak sauce.
I have to add something to that, though, real quick. That's, I have to say,
by all means. Yeah, sure.
I disagree with the comic book characterization. I've always compared Ayn Rand to being she wrote trashy romance novels with bad philosophy chucked in them. I mean, it goes beyond the comic book. It's just, it's really trashy romance novel stuff.
Yeah. And even now, even, you know, in the face of, I'm going to do a public debate with this guy, even now I can't stand to read, I can't bear to read the novels, so I'm just reading the nonfiction treatments here. Capitalism, the unknown ideal. May we one day know it. I guess the 19th century, before unions and regulation and environmental laws and worker safety controls, that wasn't free enough. Like, the 19th century is the petri dish of pure laissez-faire capitalism, and we get giant monopoly. Like, that's the era of the biggest monopolies of history, like Rockefeller's oil monopoly, Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, monopolies in appliances and cigarettes in that era. You know, shooting workers who go on strike. Like, that's what happens when you really have an unregulated system. These buffoons like to act like that era never took place. And they say, like, oh, we've never been able to have capitalism because OSHA exists and the EPA has some regulation. So, oh, it's held back. And the best thing about her work, of course, is that Atlas Shrugged idea. Like, it's a story about the CEOs going on strike. Like, on the left, we say, you know, the power of the workers is that we are needed to do production. And if we go on strike, like, that's how we show our power, by refusing to work for the system and make it break down, do a sit down strike, seize the means of production, all these classic left wing stratagems. Like, Atlas Shrugged is her idea where, like, okay, all the capitalists go on strike and we all discover, like, oh, the world can't work without them. They all went off somewhere and they have an ideal society. I don't know who the fuck she thinks is going to be cleaning their toilets and emptying their trash cans. Think of a bunch of CEOs go to an island somewhere. Very quickly, you're going to find they're also bringing in a migrant workforce of some type. It's just laughable. It's laughable. But, you know, I made this agreement, so I put myself in this jail cell. I'm just bitching about it.
But the only other thing I would say to that is it's odd. I don't think that libertarian was always necessarily associated with the Libertarian Party. I think, you know, there's the term libertarian socialist. It used to be a term that more left-wingers used, and I feel like they hijacked it from us, so to speak.
It's not just a feeling, man. Like, it originates, yeah, like French anarchist movements, you know, like Les Libertaires and stuff like that. But there is, I don't have one handy, but there is a very well-known quote by Murray Rothbard, who's one of the more purist writers in the libertarian tradition, whereas like Hayek and Friedman advised governments and inevitably, you know, you compromise whatever horrible ideals you have when you work for power. But Rothbard, you know, is considered a more like intellectually consistent, like purist type. And he has a very prominent, you know, a well-known quote where he says, like, yeah, libertarian, that was on the left. I liked it and we used it. We stole it from them so that we could use it. Like, he was very, very, like, you couldn't ask for a clear description there. But yeah, like, there's that whole long libertarian tradition on the left where, you know, like the entities like states, hierarchical churches, which are still very powerful in a lot of the world, and obviously industry and capitalism. Like, these are all structures of hierarchy and dominating and controlling people. Yeah, your libertarian left or your libertarian socialist tradition, especially figures like Chomsky, who somehow we still have, it's a long tradition, and we're the ones with a consistent view of power and authority. Like, we don't want to be controlled by power to the extent that we need big institutions, like big economic institutions, so we can have economies of scale and keep our iPhones and food relatively affordable and produce on a mass basis for all the people. We still need big concentrated production, like with economies of scale, to do that. But we should control them democratically. Like, the workers should control that. They should send representatives up, and those representatives are recallable at any time. We have this whole left-wing tradition that I look at in the last chapter of that book on how we can socialize the economy in a way that makes it democratically responsive, not just a government nationalization, but how are the actual workers in charge of the means of production? Like, that comes out of that whole left libertarian tradition. So yeah, we shouldn't let them get away with that shit.
See, it's us on the left. We're the defenders and the guardians of freedom. That's how I put it to people. We want emancipation. You mentioned Chomsky. I have to note, Chomsky has a blurb on the cover of your new book: a badly needed study of the giant high-tech corporations. I think that is a great honor to have Chomsky speaking so highly of bit tyrants.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. I'm actually, he blurred my last book too, and the one before that. I'm 3 for 3 right now.
That's a hat trick.
Yeah, it is. That's I'm an economist. I have no shame, so I'll just bother people again and again and again. I don't have any, like, you know, inner moral core. I'm an economist. I got rid of that a lot. Time ago.
I'm curious, because I just thought of this. How has it been sort of being an economist that's on the left? Because when people think of economists, we immediately think, right wing sort of deregulate everything. What has that sort of experience been like? And maybe that's a lead into bit tyrants, because I wanted to ask how you got into wanting to look at Silicon Valley.
Yeah, right on. So what it's like to be on the left when you're an economist, it sucks. You're right. Like, economists are considered very widely to be the conservatives of the social sciences, you know. So sociology is well known to have a lot of, you know, left or liberal people, you know, and faculty and research there. And political science is much more of a mixture. But with economics, you know, you do have, you know, the Keynesian tradition, people who are more liberal there, but it's definitely the most conservative, you know, the more conservative, you know, neoclassical school completely dominates the undergrad curriculum and indeed like graduate work, you know. So being on the left in the field is very goofy. And I have a lot of exchanges at conferences and so on with my colleagues where they are clutching their pearls at the not market conforming things I say. It's a ridiculous field. Like, economics has the biggest ego by far of any social science, which is amazing because our record is a pile of garbage. All we do is fail to predict the big events. You know, I'm old enough to have been teaching during like the run up to the financial bubble in the 2008, you know, financial crisis. No one, those of us who were saying there could, we had no idea how bad it was going to be. I will say that for my part. I was at least like, this is a housing bubble at the very least. Perhaps a recession will be caused. I had no idea what the scale of the event would be. It was a lonely experience, let me tell you, saying that there was anything unlikely to happen. Much more likely, you know, you have economists, you know, projecting future growth. Yes, we could see a market correction in housing, but that shouldn't derail things. And all the way up to the really shallow economists, guys like Larry Kudlow, who appear on TV and are now one of Trump's main economic advisors. He said that the Bush boom will continue. And then the giant crash and a $2 trillion congressional and Federal Reserve bailout were required. We have a terrible, terrible record in economics. We support the worst institutions. We support policies like tax cuts, which don't grow the economy. They just make it more unequal, and we don't even care. It's a pretty hideous field. But if you talk to these guys, the egos are the biggest egos you can possibly imagine. And we're so sophisticated. And oh, the mathematical models we use, which are built on goofy premises that ignore the warts of capitalism. So it all falls apart pretty
bad. I was going to say, and I don't mean to like disparage the field of economics, but I've told people in the past, sometimes I feel like when I'm talking to a lot of economists, I'm talking to people that have sort of like they're almost like mystics at times in their belief in the mathematical models. And I said, I don't mean to disparage.
Oh, of course. I'll disparage it. You leave it to me. I'm a professional. Yeah, you know, I like to turn to really crazy radical left-wing figures like George Bush Sr., who is, you know, again, well on the record. People have been talking about this for decades, is referring to Reagan's supply-side trickle-down economics where we do big tax cuts on the rich and that benefits everyone else. It's become the, you know, the Republican tax policy cornerstone for our lifetimes, you know. He called it voodoo economics, George Bush, you know, Sr., George G.H.W. Bush. I think that was during the primary before he became the VP pick. You know, I forget. You can look up that quote. But it's a known tradition to look at economists and go, are these guys really full of shit? Like, it's not a crazy opinion to take. We're wrong constantly. I look forward to us being wrong about what happens with this virus. That'll be exciting too. So that's economics. For Bit Tyrants, really when I finish Capitalism versus Freedom, you know, finishing a book is a big years-long enterprise. So you have to like pause and take stock about what your next step will be. But I just noticed, just reading, it's the capitalist business press. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal every day so I can keep up with the economy. And the reporting in the business press is so candid and so earnest. And, you know, they talk about how powerful these firms are and the sneaky ways that they're controlling markets or cornering the supply of some commodity. And they say, oh, and the firm should make a lot of money from that. So that's good news for their stockholders. Like, they never go, wow, this is a satanically evil power play. Pharmaceutical company taking drugs away from the dying. They go like, oh, well, those investors should see a very good return on their early investment. That's exciting. But it's a very useful a tool for learning about the world. And just one thing I was just noticing reading the various business media that we have access to, it's like, wow, these tech platform firms, like Microsoft's been a hugely important monopolist or semi-monopolist in a lot of markets for years. But with the rise of Google and Facebook and Amazon, like these guys are taking over the economy. And the big thing that made me want to write a full-on book about them, I always tell people this, is like for the last several years, the five biggest firms in the world are tech platform companies.
And that's very unusual for the five biggest firms to all be from the same market. Yeah.
I don't know of another era, like even the Gilded Age, like it wasn't just railroads at the top of the economy. And we have much more limited records for that era anyway. But yeah, right now it's Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook. Like those are the big five, not counting the part of the Saudi oil company, Saudi Aramco, which got floated, which is a very royal family manipulated process. No one takes that valuation seriously. So those are the five biggest firms. I'm just looking at their power and just thinking how, I mean, just what you and I would think, what everyone thinks of. God, I use my phone all the time and for everything. We use them to, you know, apply for jobs and to shop and to socialize and, you know, go on dates and get laid. Like everything runs through those phones and through those application platforms that run on them. And I realized like, we're so reliant on these firms. They are the great dominant firms of our time. You know, someone should write a big book dissecting them and shitting on their leadership.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Gilded Age. I always have new listeners that are like, not necessarily up on history as much. So maybe you could describe the Gilded Age for, well, I'm just going to say it. My mom listens and she's always like, I don't know what you're talking about. Some of it goes over my head. So I want to give her and others a chance to maybe learn a little bit of history with regards to the Gilded Age and how it connects to our current period.
Right on. Sure, man. Moms are a good writing, speaking reference point, you know, because it gets you outside your sphere of, well, everyone's familiar with the problems of the Depression. Like, nah, not really. People don't know a lot of this stuff. So it's good to back up. You know, the Gilded Age is a term that historians use to refer to the late 19th century in the Western world. So in Western Europe, and especially the U.S., basically the period from the Civil War up until World War I, the giant disruptions of those conflicts. That's the period of the American Industrial Revolution and our big economic growth to where we grow to be bigger than the grand European colonial economies of that time. And if you look at that era, it's very much a, again, like we were saying before, like a laissez-faire experiment in capitalism. You know, no regulation, no labor unions, no antitrust laws to stop your monopolies. And what do we see? Is it the nice competitive landscape that Friedman and Fred Hayek are telling us we're going to see, where everyone can compete and it's a level playing field and we get these optimal, stable outcomes? It's the opposite of that. We get gigantic oligopolies and monopolies. So Rockefeller had his oil monopoly then. He would use, cunning and money and threats, and he would use that to consolidate oil producers into his Standard Oil trust structure, which is what big businesses had before we had incorporation, which kind of doesn't come till the turn of the century. And we get huge monopolies in all these industries then, tons of economic instability, huge manic market periods, and then giant crashes. In the 1890s, we had this incredibly long recession that actually at that time was called the Great Depression. And it was called that until the 1930s, when it got topped by another capitalist crash that destroyed the economy for 10 years. So it's a period of incredible power, market power, power of money and monopoly from guys like Rockefeller and Carnegie, and crushing workers, shooting strikers, tons of instability. Like, that's the laissez-faire experimental period for capitalism, So it's an interesting era. Like, people who defend the system don't like to focus on that. Friedman breezes through it in his book and says, well, yes, there were monopolies, but they passed. He doesn't mention they passed because the government broke them up through antitrust law in those days. And he briefly mentions that most people came into the country poor in that era and still died poor. Remember that he said, but they went in with their eyes open. Like, we're supposed to like that, So it's an era that defenders of capitalism are crazy about because it kind of disproves most of the things they say happen to free unregulated markets. But something to bear in mind today when these guys call for, we should try a new unregulated capitalism. Like, we've been taking steps in that direction for 40 years. And as we have done so, the Gilded Age has sort of come back. Like, it is connected to today. So now, we tax, we've gone through, 4 or 5 major rounds of tax cuts for the wealthiest households and biggest corporations in the country. And we've removed a lot of environmental laws. The labor market, the labor movement has been fairly crushed, going from a union density north of 20% in the early 50s down to the single digits today. Counting private and public sector workers. So you crush the unions, we've got very weak antitrust enforcement. And what do we have? We have gigantic billionaire fortunes who can just run for the Democratic Party if they feel like it. They have so many billions of dollars. And we have huge monopolistic corporations that are now much more invasive of our daily lives, maybe. So it's a real second coming of the Gilded Age. And all it took was 40 years of the Republican Party tearing down the New Deal welfare state to get us back to it. And by God, I think they've done it.
I think there's something to be said, too, about the supposed philanthropy of those Gilded Age robber barons.
Indeed.
We're based out of Pittsburgh, so, seeing Carnegie's name plastered on a bunch of libraries and streets and shit is a constant reminder of how they also bought the public trust in many ways, that they reshaped their own image in the same way that Bill Gates has kind of reshaped his image as a philanthropist over the course of the past couple decades, so that you don't focus on the horrid labor abuses and the instances of neocolonial policy. And I was just hoping you could, I don't know. That's also a point worth making, I think. Absolutely. We're seeing a lot more repetition in that regard too.
Absolutely, that has come back too. Yeah, I actually just had an article on Jacobin about the Gates Foundation. People, that is something that people reach for very quickly to defend these billionaire douchebags, is to say, well, but they give it away. Some, anyway. And if you look at it, and I was talking about this in Jacobin, Gates, when he was making his big $1 billion donations to the foundation, which is when it got the big kernel of the money it manages today, it was during specifically that period in the 90s when Microsoft was going through its antitrust trial, and every night on the nightly news, which is a thing people watched at that time, it would be Bill Gates saying something on the stand and then proven to have lied when his own emails were entered into the court record. like that'll make you look like a scumbag very quick. Plus all the crushing of tiny firms and destroying Netscape to take over that market. That's why Microsoft got legally adjudicated to be a monopolist. It is a monopolist even in the eyes of the law, which is very unusual. But that's when Gates did that. Like, he put that money in when he was looking like shit in the press day after day. And back then, like, he, you know, his character would be on The Simpsons as a bullying, dorky scumbag. Now he's like the sweet grandfatherly figure who fights malaria. That's nice. And of course, the Gates Foundation obviously puts a lot of money into like important NGOs and charities that fight real diseases and try to do something about development, you know, in the third world. But compared to the full need, it's tiny. And they even say that. But it's mainly something that launders their reputations. And Carnegie, I mean, it's another classic case. You know, he had his managers fire on the Homestead strikers. But people, is that what people think of when they hear Carnegie? They go, oh, that's on that library in my town. You know, I'm from Indiana myself, you know, not too far away. And Carnegie's name's on every damn public building in sight, you know. So it really is a very effective way and a cost-effective way, too, compared to the money these guys make. The amount of monies that they disperse are pretty modest. It's a great way to launder your reputation if you're a bullying, ruling class scumbag. It definitely works then and now.
I was going to say it's interesting when we look at the Gilded Age in the past. I always reference to people, I'm like, more people should read Upton Sinclair. Go read Oil and then watch the movie There Will Be Blood that it was based on. But I feel like books like Bit Tyrants or David Galumbia's The Politics of Bitcoin, these are going to be the books that we're all reading in 30 years and saying, wow, these guys are right. Silicon Valley did not turn out to be as utopian as everyone thought it would be. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that in particular. There is this idea on both amongst the liberal Democrats, I think a lot of times, and the right wing that, oh, Silicon Valley is so good. They're doing so much good. And the liberals like them because, oh, they're so socially progressive. And I'm not as trusting of that. I don't think everyone in Silicon Valley is like a, you know, hyper reactionary, but I think the view we get of it is very cartoonish.
It's true. And, you know, in my book, you know, in Bit Tyrants, I have a chapter on each of the big five, those five biggest companies in the world, those platform giants, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. And one of the sections in each of those chapters is just on their labor record and who they've employed and what conditions and how horrible are they. And that's interesting, but it meant, you know, I did real research on this. And if you look at these firms, yeah, that people see as being so progressive, like Google or Facebook, for example, very clearly, what you discover is that it's not so much the management of these firms who never want to stick their neck out, who seldom want to jeopardize business relationships or government relationships by taking big political stances. It's very reliably the workforce that does that. You know, it's the Google staff that's doing walkouts over a giant golden parachute for noted sex abuser Andy Rubin. And they're the ones threatening to go on strike over developing AI for the Pentagon to use in drone strikes to blow up penniless Yemeni civilians. You know, it's the workforce that gives a shit about that and is threatening to do things about it. And similar at Facebook, Amazon, you know, just had a walkout recently on Staten Island because they wanted Amazon to close down and do a deep cleaning of their facility for the coronavirus after a few workers there were diagnosed with it. And, you know, they let a walkout to call for that. And Amazon fired one of the organizers for coming back to work. And, you know, it's disputed now. So it's usually the workforce that's the driving force of that. But, of course, what you also discover, too, is like much of America's younger workforce, they tend to be either like big Bernie left liberals or wretched right-wing libertarian scumbags like I forget his first name, DeMore. He's that Google engineer.
Scott DeMore, yeah.
Yes.
The people I think of are like the really out there ones. Like there's one Curtis Yarvin, Mencius Moldbug is his like these are like some scary figures. I think a lot of the stuff Scott DeMore says is just, it's gross.
It is gross. You know, so he was fired for circulating an internal memo through Google's, you know, employee messaging system saying the reason why women are disproportionately underrepresented in engineering, software engineering and coding is that, you know, they're not smart enough. Their brains aren't up to writing code, which is a very scummy, misogynist, dumb thing to say. And so
he false when you look at like the examples of the former Soviet republics where you have a rough parity between the two. When you have an equal distribution of society's resources, who
indeed
would have thought?
Or even on this side of the Cold War, we had those women workers, women working as the computers. You had the job of being a computer, so we can have a space program. That's routine work, though. That's boring. Running the operation is the thing for men. Let women do all the math. Like, it's the opposite of this thing. It's funny.
I have to add something here. Everyone that says this whole, like, oh, women can't do math and computing and all this stuff, I always say to them, you guys know who Ada Lovelace is? And inevitably, they will say, who is that? And I'm like, oh, you guys don't even know your history.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, there's, like, very prominent, like, fascinating woman characters, yeah, in the history of computing and technology in general, obviously. It's just a dumb dude, self-satisfying thing to say, and you think you're going to get laid by telling this truth to women in bars because you see that in movies. It's dumb. And so, of course, he gets fired for this, and then he said, you know, Google's infringing on my free speech. But then, you know, he's supposed to be conservative, so you eventually realize, you know, a classical liberal. Libertarian. So he realizes, like, oh, that's right. I'm at someone's private property. Google is private property. Our whole thing is it's corporate private property. If you don't like it, start your own Google. That'll make them unpopular soon. But because he doesn't have any legal recourse, Damore then turned to another step, which is suing Google under a California state law, which makes it illegal for a worker to be fired for expressing their political opinion. Like, it's a liberal state law that he's turned to because he doesn't have any normal recourse because he supports platforms being private property, you know? But so, yeah, like, Damore at least is relatively conventional. The guys you're talking about are, like, these twisted, conspiratorial, you know, singularity-obsessed, seasteading freaks. Like, those guys are very interesting. I don't talk about them a ton in the book. In the book, I was trying to look at, like, the big five, the super powerful mega institutions of Silicon Valley. It's filled with fascinating freaks and weirdo characters. There's definitely more to read about it outside of my book, although people should read my book.
Well, I'm curious. You mentioned in this book Tyler Cowen. You mentioned him early on. He has a quote where he says something along the lines of, you know, if all of this big tech stuff was so bad, people would be pushing back against it by not using the apps. They wouldn't be using Facebook and the social media. Obviously, the benefits outweigh the costs. How would you respond to Cowen's sort of flippant, like, stop being a critic? Ah.
Yeah, Cohen's always a good person to pick up for this sort of stuff. He's, you know, prominent East Coast economist with an impeccable, you know, educational background. He's a fucking imbecile. And he's so lame that Nathan Robinson and I, who folks may know as the editor of Current Affairs, he and I have written, I think, two articles about him so far specifically. It's because his preposterously oblivious statements like that. And other ridiculous comments that he's made. Folks can Google our names and his name and find that very quickly. It's some juicy stuff there. It's a nice, easy, slow-moving target, Cohen. You know, I wake up in the morning and freshen up by reading what he says and using a rifle to shoot a hole in it. So Cohen says, yeah, exactly. Like, if these things are so bad, why do people keep using them? Well, like most economists, he doesn't understand the economy. So the big issue with markets like these technology-based markets that we're talking about, is that they're characterized by an economic phenomenon called network effects or the network externality. And that's just the unique feature of some of these markets. I always tell my students, you know, in econ, we usually say, here's how markets work. They have supply and demand and they come in balance and everyone's happy and we sing songs. And, you know, some markets are stable and match that sort of basic description. Others don't. The fact is, markets have a lot of variety. I mean, think of all the different goods and services that we consume during a day. They're so different from one another. Why would the markets be similar, you know? And so what we see is some markets, especially ones that are based on connecting users or sharing information, they tend to be characterized by a network-based pattern. We call this thing network effect. And the key version of it is when more people use the service, it gets more valuable for other people. So when people get phones, like that's, you know, when people, you know, like turn 14 and they get a phone from their parents or whatever, it actually makes your cell phone slightly more valuable because it's increasing the number of people you might potentially call or want to connect to. And when people join Facebook or Twitter or other stupid social media platforms of today, it makes your account slightly more valuable because there's more parties you could interact with, more people who might see your work or whatever it is you do. And so we call that the network effect. When more people use it, it gains value for existing users. You know, if I buy a pair of sneakers and, you know, it doesn't make your sneakers more valuable, but it does for markets based on networks. It's just their unique, weird characteristics. Well, network effects have a couple of big ramifications for markets. One is that they're even more prone to monopolization than usual. And again, capitalism has a long history of that without network effects. Like, Rockefeller built up Standard Oil through economies of scale and market power mongering and arm twisting, traditional capitalist tools of monopoly. But with these guys, because we have this network effect, it means that, you know, one social network tends to become dominant. Are you going to join the social media network that none of your friends are on, or the one that all of your friends are on? Like, it just really favors one single dominant incumbent. And so this was the case with Microsoft's stupid Windows operating system that didn't end up on every work computer because people love Windows so much. It happened because it was on the early IBM PC. And so people designed games and applications to run on Windows. And those applications attract more users. That bigger user base attracts more programmers. And you end up with a positive feedback, creating a monopoly with a small niche for Apple, which, God bless them. But Jobs missed a couple opportunities to exploit network effects, both with his original Macintosh PCs and with the move to mobile, where he closed the platform both times and prevented network effects. Steve Jobs gets a lot of credit for being a visionary. He's arguably the dumbest CEO of all the ones that I look at because he never understands platform economics and network effects. Neither does Tyler Cohen, to actually answer your question. He says, why don't people stop using them? Because they're social standards. Like, it's YouTube for online video. It's Google for mobile search. It's Facebook for social media. And it's Amazon for online retail. Those things are so dominant, walking away from them is not plausible. Even just changing your phone from an Android to an Apple or vice versa is a monumental pain in the ass, moving all of your photos and all your music and many apps you have to rebuy on your new phone. So there's an expense. Some apps are only on one platform or another, so you have to give some up. It's a goddamn nuisance, and that's on purpose. It's to lock you in. So a big feature of these network-based markets is you end up locked in to using YouTube for video or using the kind of phone you have because switching is not plausible, or even if there is a second alternative, like with phones, we have a two-company oligopoly there for operating systems. It's just such a nuisance. It's harder than, it's a bigger pain than changing your, like, your bank, which is bad enough already, you know. So Cohen doesn't understand those things because he's not serious. Is the answer to that question. Like a lot of economists, you know, he's a huge following. He writes for The Economist. He goes on TV to talk about this stuff. These are the economists that the system elevates, these empty-headed buffoons who know how to say pretty sound bites and write readable books that are heaps of dumb garbage. This is the state of the field. I don't know how I ended up in economics. I must have made bad life choices.
So I guess pushing back a little bit more on the sort of mythology of the political economy is Silicon Valley. Oh, these companies are all socially progressive and this is all great and they're innovative and disruption is good. What do you think the biggest negative impacts of the political economy of Silicon Valley, and in particular, companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, what is the negative impact that they're having on us as a society?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, like, it's a huge new industry. So it has a lot of positive and negative impacts, you know. And again, the first page of my book, I say, let me begin by saying I use these companies' products constantly. I wrote the book on an Apple laptop. I used Amazon cloud storage. You know, I promoted it. I annoyed my friends on Facebook with it, you know. So you can't avoid these things. So obviously, they use these fun they provide these new services and products. Many of them are free. So like the upside of it is clear, and they make sure on TV ads and through lobbying that everyone knows the good sides. But there's a number of ugly downsides. I mean, one is that, you know, it's just a new wave of powerful tyrants that exploit and abuse their labor force. That's enduringly popular. But there's big changes too. You know, like it's relatively well recognized now that the advent of smartphones like changed human behavior in like non-trivial ways, like the amount of obsessive checking that we do, the effect that social media has on us. So many people now, the first thing you do in the morning, you wake up and you look at your phone. Anyone try to talk to me? What's happening on the platforms? Like, it's changed our consciousness in a lot of ways. I mean, hell, I feel like I talk about this all the time, but I'm just still blown away with it. Kids have tablets now. Like, kids, like, have, like, you know, like, phones or big, you know, phone tablets, you know. That's amazing to me. And I never blame the parents, because, you know, if you see parents with kids, like, it's the 24-hour-a-day job, and you can't quit, and you don't want to quit, because you're emotionally attached. But, oh, my God, what parents go through. Of course you're going to let your kid watch TV. And now you have a little tablet they can take anywhere. So, you know, you can, like, immobilize them. I totally understand the parental side of it. But kids are growing up with tablets. I mean, I'll say this. I say this without shame. If I had had a tablet when I was a little kid, I would be a illiterate, penniless virgin today. Who's learning to work, go to school, learning to flirt with people. Like, that's hard. Like, that's uncomfortable, difficult times. If you have a tablet and you have the bottomless ocean of video on YouTube, I would not have learned to do anything else. Like, I worry a little bit about these kids today, just because we're putting this crazy technology in their hands, and because their parents are exploited, exhausted workers running between jobs. Of course, they give that tech to their kids just so they can manage their day, you know. So, you know, negative impacts, I mean, that's a big one. Another one is, like, these firms control our information, our access to information, in a way that even, you know, the classic old media that Chomsky and Herman wrote Manufacturing Consent about, like, those firms couldn't aspire to the control that Facebook and above all Google have right now over our information systems. The longest chapter in my book is the one where I talk about Google, because it's so important and it has the nicest, cutest reputation. Like, you need to understand, like, they have a long history. They will not shrink from upranking in their search results things they like and downranking things they don't. And if you have a successful online retail price comparison service, Google may suddenly downrank you to page 9 of its search results, which is enough to kill businesses most of the time, because they want to use their own Google price comparison shopping service to try to compete with Amazon. And on YouTube, you know, there they have the goal of trying to keep you on the platform, whereas Google search, they try to move you on as fast as they can. There, they want to keep you on the site as long as possible, maximize view time and ads viewed, you know. And that has meant moving people toward content that locks them and keeps them on the platform, which has meant, like, crazier, more extreme content, especially for news-related stuff. And just right now, because YouTube is so vast and the money you can make from getting ads on your videos is such a great passive source of income, like, there are algorithmically generated just weird-ass videos all over YouTube. And it's, like, a lot of it is for kids. Like, it's program content where we've got licensed character models and we have them do some dumb 90-second thing on the cheapest basis possible. Kids are growing up watching this stuff. So the negative effects, I mean, are relatively visible beyond your standard labor exploitation.
I was going to say, are you familiar with, I don't know if you mentioned it in the book, but there was a book that came out a few years ago. I'm forgetting the author. It was called Weapons of Math Destruction.
Of course. O'Neill's book. Yes. I talk about that book. It's fascinating.
I thought it was, you know, I thought that book got way too much. It got attacked a lot because people were saying, oh, she's saying that math is racist. So that's not what she's saying. She's saying that these algorithms are not perfect and they can really contribute to these social problems we have.
That's a great point. It seems
like people try not to understand the issues, like the issues of surveillance and how these things are connected to big tech.
Absolutely. And that's a great point, too. Our book's fantastic. People are idiots. We have racist institutions, and then we computerize them. We say, see, now they run on computers, so it's objective now. Like, now you made software to fulfill the existing goals of your corporate or police or military institution. Like, using technology doesn't make it a dispassionate institution. It's just pursuing its same shitty power-mongering goals as before, just using fancy technology, yes, with the mathematical algorithm at the heart of it. People have ridiculous ideas. Of course, no one's read the book. They just shit on it and tweet that out and move on. It's pretty embarrassing. Well, Neil's book is very good. Everyone should read that. And The tracking thing is a big part of it, you know. So, for example, yeah, like using algorithms to predict where crime is most likely to happen in a town is something that a lot of police departments, including in my own city here in Tacoma, have a history of paying for. And of course, it's, oh, well, here in these poor areas with the non-white residents and the poor ones overall, like this is where we see a lot of crime. So move more, you know, move more cop cruisers down there and do more patrol. And of course, like that's the long history of racist disproportionate policing. If you're in a poor black community, you're going to have a lot more cruisers, patrol units rolling through, you know, creates a suppressive atmosphere. It means when you're doing petty legal violations, like having a drink on the sidewalk or smoking a joint, like you'll be the people who get spotted by the cops and locked up, not someone who's smoking a joint in their nice suburban home in their nice spacious backyard. No algorithm's going to like send cops by to look at that. So you can easily have nice mathematical underpinnings for your processes and still be a racist dirtbag. But also the tracking thing you mentioned is a huge deal. Obviously, like by now, it amazes me, like younger people who I talk to, even people my own age, and certainly the younger ones, just say like, yeah, privacy's dead. We've lost it. And I mean, they have a point. And again, I quote Joshua Levine's book, Surveillance Capital, a lot in my books. It's so good. I just stole a lot of his stuff, basically. People should read his book.
I think that's Surveillance Valley.
Surveillance Valley. Sorry. Yes. Joshua Levine's book. A lot of books up here. And like that book, I thought I knew a lot about this. It's absolutely fascinating. And he makes the point like Apple and Google, you know, through their maps and through the GPS systems in the phones themselves, plus the phone issuer, which might be someone else like Samsung, like they know what you do. Like it's amazing. Just your GPS alone and like the Wi-Fi handshakes that your phone handset makes as you walk around the city. Just that location data alone tells them so much about our lives. Like they know when we get laid, like two phones that have no relationship, like are both in a bar and then they go back to one of the phone's houses. Like that's, you don't have
it's
to be
creepy to think about.
I'm no detective, but I think I understand what's happening there. Like it's just like the pattern's just so clear. Even if they're not trying to be creeps, like the data just puts this knowledge in their hands, you know? And they do, of course, dissect it and try to predict things from it. And, you know, they know what, like, these filmmakers, they know things you don't tell, like, your closest friends. Like, if you get a secret, shameful abortion, because you have wrong ideas about abortion, you think it's bad, maybe you don't tell even your family. But, like, the phone knows. The phone knows you went to Planned Parenthood after that hookup two nights ago. Like, they know what's going on. It's so manifest. And, of course, everything else, like the, you know, these microphones that are often always on because people want to use digital assistants, the record of the messages you send and your hours of use, and the amount of information these firms have about us is extensive. And so what's happening now is a lot of younger people are just saying, yeah, privacy is dead. I've just accepted it. We should not just accept it. Like right now, the only meaningful regulations that have been put on this industry have mainly been in the European Union. We may have this change here once the virus is over and we go back to all these investigations that the firms were under, they're kind of been put on ice while we get through this crisis, of course, like everything else. But in the EU, we have the big GDPR, the big data privacy regulatory system, which is extensive and requires the firms to limit how much tracking they do and to store all their data on European peoples in their country rather than siphoning it all back to a cloud system based in the US, you know. Limitations on like how they can hide their revenue so they limit their tax bill. The EU has been going after this, but a lot of it, like their privacy laws, I mean, they're a start. They have a lot of limitations, but they have teeth. We could do that too, and we should. We shouldn't accept that these firms have all this power. And you know, right now, Apple is, I have a chapter on them in the book. They are the company right now out of the Silicon Valley Big Five that have some reasonable case for taking privacy seriously. And, you know, and I have an iPhone. But of course, you know, they take all the data. They're happy to use my handset data, but they do favor privacy up to a point. Like they don't share the data out and they require you to opt in for data sharing on apps on the phone and so on. But then of course that led to, I think it was Zuckerberg, I believe, one of the other tech titans shot back. You're like, yeah, well, privacy can't be a luxury good, you know, because your phones are fucking expensive, Apple. So it's something we shouldn't take as a fait accompli, that's for sure.
Didn't Apple also had a little tiff with Google that you mentioned in the book? I think like Apple threatened Google at one point.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like their history is really interesting because, you know, in 2006, the only mobile smartphone there was the iPhone. Like back then iPhone just meant smartphone, you know? Mm-hmm. And because Steve Jobs is an imbecile and never understood platform economics. You know, he didn't allow an open market for people to create applications for years until the App Store was created. And even that, of course, is tightly curated by Apple itself, and it has a ton of reasons, some of them secret, for why it rejects apps, you know. But back in those early days, they were desperate for applications to make their fancy phone useful. And Google was so important to them because they came with a suite of useful apps, Google Search, YouTube, and Google Maps, and of course, and Gmail eventually. So very, very useful to this day, of course, extremely popular, some of the most popular applications in the whole tech ecosystem. And so that was a huge deal. And they had that early partnership between, you know, the Google founders, Page and Brin, and Steve Jobs. But eventually, the Google founders wanted to create their own smartphone operating system, which eventually became what we have as Android today, which is hugely dominant, partially because it's an open system. So it exploits the network effects that Steve Jobs is too dumb to understand. But it was a huge falling out with them. Yeah, and he threatened to sue them and made them take, like, the, you know, the finger swipey interface to get through your security lock. He made them take that off the earliest Android operated smartphones because it was, it's our intellectual property. The originators of these markets always think that they should get to have a monopoly forever, and they want to crush competitors. Like Bill Gates is on the record saying, we've got to crush companies, and slamming his fist into his hand like that. Many, you know, of his biographers describe it.
It's funny. I was recently reading more about Peter Thiel, and I found out that he said once, actually, oh, I don't actually like competition. That's bad for my business.
Oh, no, he's written about it. Like, it's not. See, he's put pen to paper on that shit. Or he had his staff do it, whatever. It's true. Like, these guys often say, oh, competition. You know, well, you should have monopoly because I'm amazing. I'm the libertarian Superman. I'm going to create this stuff. I shouldn't have competition. I should own this industry as my property forever, you know? These guys are real Prince Charming figures, it's true. But Apple and Google, like, they have that whole huge falling out. Now they're giant competitors for smartphone operating systems, but they will still sometimes work together. So just this last week, Google and Apple did a rare joint announcement, which never happens. They hate each other for daring to exist. And it's, you know, to try to track coronavirus, the infected, if you opt into this application system, it's supposed to keep the data on your phone. It doesn't go to a cloud, but it lets you know if your phone location data shows you've been exposed for a significant amount of time to someone who has themselves been exposed or been diagnosed with the virus. And as testing gradually ramps up this summer, that could help us move over to a testing and isolate regime, which is a much more efficient way to fight a pandemic, and everyone else can go back to work and society can be resurrected and so on. What's impressive about it is not only did they do a joint announcement, even though they hate each other's guts, but they also released some of the code, which never happens. You know, that's their intellectual property. They never release that. But they want to show that it's, you know, above board and the data stays on your phone and we aren't going to use this to track you. And obviously it's an opt-in system. So I've been arguing lately, like, the tech firms see this crisis as an opportunity. I mean, they're gaining power. We're all more reliant on their stupid platforms than ever now with our Zoom meetings and Google Hangouts and lonely people going on Facebook and YouTube even more than we did previously. So they're gaining in this crisis, but they also know, like, they're going up against investigations, which will come back in time. And they are now seen by a lot of the public as, you know, hoarding their data and so on. So they're happy to use this as an opportunity to polish their reputations a little bit, much like Gates and his foundation. So they're on their best behavior, I'm sort of arguing, is the most recent turn for these guys. Like, we've all got to fight this virus together, guys. And we here at Gigantic Co. are part of the response. We're part of the family. And please remember, when we go back to normal, not to be too aggressive about taking apart our corporate empires. Because remember how we did a few nice things during the crisis. We'll see how much that fools people. But goofy relationship between those companies. It's like the Gilded Age billionaires. They fight sometimes. Like, it's bad enough that they exist and they control our society, but they fight. Like, Rockefeller and Carnegie were competing, buying up railroads and shutting them down to force the other one to, like, buy or sell their companies to one another. When they fight, it's like they buy the interstate highways and turn them off. Like, the power these guys have over our society is amazing. And when they get into conflict, that's one of the times you really see it.
So this has been leading up to the one part of the book that I really wanted to talk about. And I'll preface this. One of the things that makes me It makes me really just angry, because I always feel like I'm being lied to when people bring up this aspect of the Silicon Valley mythology, is when people talk about these are the, like you said, the libertarian Superman and their private sector will save us. Look at the innovation, and they've disrupted things, but it's innovative. They're so innovative. And you know, I always say to those people, well, I bring up that urban legend. There's that urban legend of Al Gore supposedly saying, I created the internet. And I bring up that urban legend because people forget all of this tech stuff doesn't exist without public sector funded research and development. And when you bring that up, it blows people's mind because they never think about it. They've never heard that history. And to me, that's the most mind-blowing part of your book, because you just get into how it's not just these libertarian tech people that gave us this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And it's true. Like, that is the go-to defense. Like, the first one is, yeah, Tyler Cohen's like, then why do you use Facebook so much? Well, because it's a monopoly, because you don't understand how these markets work. Like, that's the first defense. But the second one is always, well, they invented the technology that lets you have your fun online profile, dude. So what are you complaining about? As soon as you look at the record, that claim completely falls apart. Like, I have been in the position now to argue with conservatives and libertarians about this. They never like come back and go, yeah, but like there's no really, if you look at this record, like it's unanswerable. So the internet itself is like the classic case. It's true. Without the fundamental inter-network technology, none of these fancy applications or big websites would be operating. You know, we did have Microsoft's operating system monopoly in the pre-internet age, so that one's arguable. But most of these firms are completely internet reliant. You know, we call them the online companies, you know. And you take a look at the history of the internet, and some folks are familiar with this, like this story is sort of known. It was a whole era in the Cold War period from the 60s and 70s up until the 90s when the internet becomes a mainstream commercial technology. It's a long era where the government, and mainly the military, couldn't get companies to give two shits about this new inter-network technology, and they couldn't sell it to them. They couldn't get them to take an interest in it. So for several decades, the internet gradually developed in the public sector, mainly through the military and the university systems and various forms of collaboration, which they do all the time in the scientific tradition. When you research stuff, you have to share your results out with other professionals, you know. So that's a pain, though, like sharing data sets with tons of data. It's a pain in the human ass. You do a big controlled experiment. There's so much data and everyone needs to look at it. Ugh. So they gradually developed this technology with what they call packet switching. I talk a little bit about it in the book, just the basic foundational technologies of sending data through originally copper wires, these days through nice glass fiber optic tubes, and moving data like that. And there was only a military and university market for that forever. So the internet's original name, after all, was DARPANET, because it was originally developed under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration, which is the Pentagon's research arm, you know, along with a couple campuses like MIT and the University of California system. And eventually they reached the point where they ran that big experiment I talk about in the book, where they sent a signal, you know, from a wire and then to through radio waves to a truck that then used a satellite connection to send the information to Europe. But they proved they could articulate all these networks together, and that's what the internet is, you know. It's all public sector because it's long-term research. Who knows if it'll ever make you any money, or who knows if it'll lead to anything, let alone if that thing will make you money. So it doesn't make sense to expect the corporate world and commercial capitalist institutions to pour money into fundamental R&D. Like, they'll take discoveries and turn them into products. Like, the pharmaceutical industry will take some new compound and turn it into a deliverable drug. Like, they will do research in that limited, this is ready to become a product stage, like that last end. But what we call fundamental research and development is almost entirely, to this day, publicly funded through the Pentagon, the military, and through the university system, and big national institutions like the National Institutes of Health and you know, the National Academy of the Sciences, the National Science Foundation. Like, that's where that funding comes from, because the government has the luxury of, we collect this tax money. Who knows if this will make any money, this research, but it's that steady, reliable funding that lets that stuff happen. So that's the internet. But all the way down to these applications, you know, like Google itself was originally google.stanford.edu. Because those grad students developed it in a very nice grad program where you got the, you know, like their mentor had National Science Foundation grant money, public funding in a stable manner. Who, don't worry about this thing making money, just do the research. And originally they said that an advertising-based search engine would have crippling conflicts of interest, and they became one, and they do. So they were right about that. But you know, Amazon, you know, like Jeff Bezos is the world's richest man, is one of the most powerful figures. He bought the Washington Post with his pocket change. Like, what's his big innovation? Well, he realized that with the internet, we can exploit that by shipping products and scaling up on the basis of that internet, that online ordering technology. And now he has a big platform with third-party sellers. And we all know about Jeff Bezos, that twitchy-eyed Lex Luthor libertarian douchebag. Even after the most expensive divorce in history, he's still the richest man in the world. Like, that's a fortune, you know. It's fun, too. Like, when they announced that divorce, I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's too bad. They have kids. You know, he and his wife have kids. You don't want to have kids going through a rough divorce. But if it was a rough divorce, they'd probably go through court. And then people, creeps like me, would get to see all of their money data, which sadly didn't – good for those kids, but bad for me. They had an amicable divorce, so I didn't get to look at those records. But all these guys, it's all based on this fundamental public sector research and development funding that let them build up their giant empires. And all, like, even like Wi-Fi was developed by the University of Hawaii so they could communicate across their island campuses and share access to computing time. If you look at the record at all, the stuff in your phone, the internet architecture behind it, even the big five themselves, they come out of public sector money. It's the opposite of the story that idiots will tell you. Well, they invented it. Well, no, they didn't. Oh, it's a very open and shut case. Yeah, that's chapter 8 of the book. It was some of the hardest research to do because it's a little bit technical, just to get to where you understand it. I think the chapter is pretty readable, though. People should take a look at that. I wrote a shortened version of it for Current Affairs a while ago. Cheating at Monopoly was the title. So folks can look that up, too, if they want a shorter take.
Before you go, just two more things. First, real briefly, you have a whole chapter on net neutrality. And that is a term that is thrown around a lot, and I still don't think most people even understand what it means.
Right on. Yeah. And we should. It's important. So net neutrality is a little bit less about these tech platform guys like Google and Amazon and more about what we call the telecom industry. Those are like the pipes that the internet comes to you through. So when you have Comcast or AT&T for your cable or internet provider, or for your cell phone carrier, if you have, you know, Verizon or T-Mobile now, that's the telecommunication industry. Like, they're between you and the content. You might have a great video you want to watch on YouTube on a server somewhere in Google's data centers, but to get that information to your phone or computer has to come to you. It'll come to you through fiber optic cables or through a cell phone tower. Well, those firms are not governed under what we call a common carrier regulation, which is a pretty, for all the crazy talk about this subject, it's a pretty basic thing. If you pick up your phone and call your favorite pizza place to order a pizza, Verizon can't look at you and go, okay, this person's calling their local pizza place. Let's have their phone call go to this other pizza place that gave us money to have pizza calls routed to it. They're not allowed to do that. They have to just connect you on the same terms as everyone else to the party you actually want to call. That's a net neutral structure. That's a network neutrality system there. AT&T has to be neutral about whoever you're calling. You get to call whoever you want to call. They don't get to route your number or slow it down if you're calling someone who didn't pay them, and speed up your, or raise your call quality if you call someone who did give them money. They're not allowed to do that because they're regulated under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. It gets technical. For a short period, from the very end of the Obama administration, these telecom companies were subject to net neutrality, to Title II common carrier regulation. The very end of the Obama administration, not a very progressive administration in the end, but that's a meaningful thing that happened. They got thousands of, literally millions of requests from people to impose these net neutrality rules. It was a victory for activism then. But then you get Trump, and that got quickly undone, so we've lost that now. It's something we should go back to. We already have enough power mongering as it is from the tech platforms themselves. We don't need an extra layer of it coming out of the telecom companies. And so far, they're taking it easy, you know, but they do have a history, like Comcast for a while. You know, remember, Comcast throttled Netflix. Like, that's fucking serious. Like, it's, like, right now, all of us quarantined watching our streaming platforms more. They slowed it down because Netflix, you know, was growing so fast and doing so much traffic. It was taking up a lot of Comcast's bandwidth across its networks. And so they wanted them to pay them more for that, or we're going to slow you down. Like, they totally have the power, and they demonstrated it in the biggest way possible by slowing down streaming video. We should go back to that. If we get lucky and somehow that walking corpse, Joe Biden, is able to beat Donald Trump, we'll have to push to bring it back. I bet we could. As much as Biden's a useless, half-dead, sex-harassing, warmongering, bankruptcy-cutting-back piece of trash, it'll be more like the Obama administration. They'll be subject to some ability to be pushed to the left, unlike the current administration, which obviously is just demonic. So maybe we can revisit net neutrality again in the future.
Casey, real quickly, and I have one more wrap-up question, but I want to give Casey a chance to talk to you. I know you've been a little bit quiet, Casey. I know you wanted to ask about Jeff Bezos, because we actually just did an interview with David Talbot of Salon.com, one of the founders of Salon, and he had a really interesting Jeff Bezos story to tell us. So I think Casey wanted to ask you about your thoughts on Jeff Bezos. Go, Casey, go.
Not just Jeff Bezos. The story itself is David Talbot was one of the founders of Salon, and they wanted to go to Amazon back in, it was either the late 90s or early 2000s, I can't remember which, and basically create like a mutually symbiotic relationship with what was at the time a book retailer. That's what Amazon originally was, after all. And it would all pretty much have been ironed out between Amazon's management and Salon's management. And then Bezos walks into the room, and like Amazon's management goes quiet and they're meekish. And Bezos is, he's a busy man, of course, you know? So he's asking hard questions like, how the fuck is this going to help me and Amazon? And when Salon's answer and when Talbot's answer didn't satisfy him, he was like, man, I should just put a gun to my mouth and pull the trigger. Like, what the hell? And then he gets back to negotiating and just really comes across as a pretentious asshole. But it reminded me of, like, Steve Jobs, his whole guru mindset, of Bill Gates and his fake philanthropy. Like, all these tech giant CEOs seem to create this culture, this cult-like following. And even though that's just one very small aspect of the grander horror that is the Tech Five, I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about what your thoughts are with regards to why these CEOs seem to be so enigmatic, we'll say.
Or just people who become, they are gurus. They are the American equivalent of the sort of Indian guru character. They've become our gurus. They are the tech gurus.
Yeah, it's true. And indeed, in each one of these chapters, I talk a little bit about their founding CEOs and their senior management. It's interesting because, yeah, typically, I mean, I didn't go into the book expecting this, but I discovered just reading, you know, these corporate biographies. Most of these books on these companies and their founders are by like business journalists, people who normally work for the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg or something like that. So they're usually not going after these guys. They're just like chronicling as much as they can, what they can learn. What you discover when you research these firms is that like their CEOs are almost without exception, like these cruel, bullying tyrants. And some of them are kind of famous for it. So Steve Jobs is kind of known for being a dick and, you know, tearing people apart. And they always punch down. They always insult and berate their like employees and their junior management, you know, always going after people that they have power over. So, you know,
they even made an entire movie about that through Facebook. The whole,
the social network. David Fincher.
That's right, yeah. And Zuckerberg is like not the biggest offender here. He's more of like a selfish cipher from what you can read about it, you know. But figures like Bezos or there you go, maybe. Like Steve Jobs are like extremely notorious. And Bill Gates too, like for berating his subordinates, screaming at them, blaming their corporate shortcomings on their incompetent management rather than their, you know, their own CEO records. As for why that's like that, you know, I don't know. It's just the structure of corporate commercial institutions, you know. Who's like JG was saying, like who's going to be the kind of person who becomes a CEO in the first place? Well, someone who's, you know, super ambitious, who kind of values, you know, rising and their own money and power more than like relationships or fair play in the market landscape or something like
that. The Citizen Kane character.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, people have like these ridiculous ideas about CEOs and they think they're like, yeah, may the best man win. You know, it's never like that. It's like Bill Gates was outraged that firms like Novell and WordPerfect were competing with them. And it was, how quickly can we get rid of these firms and remove the competition from the marketplace so that we can have this monopoly? Like, they're just rushing to get to that stage as quickly as they can. So it's a pretty ugly record, man. Yeah, like in the book, I just look a little bit at these guys and their history. And again, just what I can learn from their mostly sympathetic corporate biographies, and they're bullying, wretched scumbags. It's a pretty ugly history, I'm not going to lie. And I did not expect that going into the book. And the Google founders are kind of the least guilty of this, you know. But like Larry Page has some pretty ugly moments. They get so annoyed at how their workforce comes to feel entitled to a share of management in the firm, you know. So they all have their pretty ugly records in there.
Do these characters, the other aspect of the mythology, and I just thought of this was, do they really come from like super humble beginnings? Like I always hear like, oh, this great technology that was innovated by such and such, it was made in his garage. And I'm like, do they really come from like, you know, as humble backgrounds most of the time?
No. No. It's bullshit. I mean, there's lots of companies. I mostly looked at the biggest five, you know, so there's lots of exceptions. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg went to private schools. Bill Gates came from a wealthy family. Like he grew up like knowing the governor of Washington. Brin and Paige come from professional class households. Like one of them has a professor parent. Jeff Bezos is the closest one because his family was, he was raised by this family. He's actually adopted this family of Cuban refugees, people fleeing the Cuban Revolution. So people who probably had money back there. And then I think his father was still an engineer though. As I recall, his adopted father. I believe that's right. That's from memory. It's mostly your white-collar professional class families. You know, these kids had good educations, time at home to think, stable home environments, you know, lots of books and, you know, culture of reading and learning in their households. These guys didn't overcome any barriers, broadly speaking, to reach their success. They just had found public technology and were ruthless scumbags. And then the rest is history.
You know, that also leads me, I just want to note really quick, is people always tell me, oh, well, Elon Musk and all these people in Silicon Valley, they must be, you know, super geniuses. They're the smartest people in the room. And I've always pushed back on that. And I feel like that's the thing that really upsets people. When you say to someone, like, the example I always use is Peter Thiel. And I'm sure Peter Thiel is smart on some level, but I read, I think it was in Forbes or Financial Times, it was an article about Peter Thiel and his obsession with René Girard, who was, you know, a weird theorist that was into mimetic theory. And apparently, the gist of the article was that he read Girard and sort of like, it implied that he lost his mind and thought he had to save the world after reading Girard. And I just thought to myself, if you read Girard and like immediately go in like head over heels with everything Girard has wrote and are completely uncritical and think the apocalypse is happening, I kind of have to question your critical thinking on some level. Just this idea that they have to be so smart that they can't get anything wrong. I've always found that such a bizarre viewpoint, but I guess people buy into the meritocracy myth.
Yeah, you know, totally. And this messianic, you know, like I'm going to save the world. I'm latch onto some obscure crackpot ideology that justifies me being powerful and taking humanity toward the singularity. I think this stuff just comes from like being that rich and powerful, you know? So we all kind of discover like, even if you're not like super powerful, if you're just a celebrity, you know, after a while, everyone around you kisses your ass. Like you're surrounded by people who, you know, want to keep their jobs with you or, you know, want to be seen as part of your, you know, social circle or whatever. Like even just celebrities end up in a totally distorted reality bubble because everyone around there, imagine if after a couple of years, everyone tells you you're great and smart and right all the time. What's that going to do to you? It's going to make you a detached, egotistical scumbag. And it's just exactly what all these guys look like. Like it's Donald Trump. It's these people who have gone for so long without anyone ever questioning them that when it happens, they just completely flip out and go nuts. And so
I always think of Sam Harris, who his mother invented the Golden Girls. I think he's had a silver spoon for a long time, but you question Sam Harris on something and it's like an attack on his being and he gets like really angry.
Yeah, Sam Harris is a ridiculous figure. What's his connection to the Golden Girls, you said?
His mother invented the show The Golden Girls.
Wow, fascinating. That's a major, you know, that's a bigger claim to fame than what he does now, frankly. He's still in his parents' shadow, I would say. You know, that's how Mitch Hurwitz got his, like, you know, head writing work. If that show didn't exist, we wouldn't have Arrested Development. So keep working, Harris. Maybe one day you'll rise to the level of your parents there. That's tough. But yeah, that's the bubble thing, though. Like, once you're in that, you really get disconnected quickly, I think. And so then, yeah, like, they get so interested in some weird pet guru that they pick up somewhere who tells them that, like, their power over people is divinely ordained. And then, of course, these guys have scandals where they're, like, sexually harassing their staff and feeling up their secretaries. No laws apply to you. You're the ruling class, you know, and they are the ruling class. Like, people want to kiss their ass and get money from them. I don't know. I just think about like what that does to you. I think a little of that goes a long way. And you end up with guys like Peter Thiel and all this, you know, singularity and seasteading shit. We're going to save everybody. Take a deep breath, you bozo. You are a ruthless businessman who came of age during the 90s when this big public investment in the internet was paying off. And then you seized on that to become a billionaire who controls the media. Like, it's not a pretty story. But these guys, yeah, don't tell them that.
I guess in closing, I always like to say that I want to end on a positive note. And I think the positive note is in the final chapter of your book where you talk about what we can do to change things. So let's just real briefly get into how can we go up against the bit tyrants and fight back?
Yeah, man, for sure. So it is tough. Like, we're talking about insanely rich and powerful institutions right now, but there's always something you can do. You know, we broke up Standard Oil. You know, we organized the auto sector when strike leaders' families used to get beat up. Like, we can get through that. We can probably do something about these white-collar dicks. So it's true. I talk in the last chapter there about an online socialism and what that would be. You know, like a lot of people, you know, I'm coming more from the left, and I would like to see, I think the real way to achieve human freedom and get more of that positive liberty where you get, you're free to consume things that are important, and that negative liberty where you're free from the power plays of others. I think to have that greatest degree of freedom, we need a real libertarian socialism. When you go to work, you and your coworkers are in charge of making the decisions about what's going to happen. You have access to the information that management usually keeps to itself, and you make the decisions it usually makes, and you can make them on a basis of solidarity and supporting your fellow man and woman and building up the society in a positive way rather than how can I wring the biggest possible amount of money out of this, you know? And so that's, you know, the traditional idea of socialism, right? Worker control of the means of production. Like, whether the industry has to be nationalized by the government for that to happen or not, like, you know, depends on the specifics. But it's not about government control with socialism traditionally. It's about worker control. So if we were to apply that to these giant online platforms, in that last chapter, I look at what that could mean and what the struggle to do that might be like, you know? And one of the first things you realize is, you know, it's interesting, like these firms, a lot of them mostly have white collar workforces, you know, very highly paid, you know, software coders and engineers. We're all familiar with the cushy benefits and workplace environments of these firms, you know, and those are traditionally not easy workers to organize because they're not exactly being exploited. I mean, Google and Apple and other firms had a long history of illegally conspiring to fix wages in their industry. I look at that in the book too. But that's sort of the exception. These are the more privileged workers of capitalism to the extent that we haven't figured out a way to automate what they do yet. They're relatively well compensated, but these firms have blue collar segments to their workforce. Amazon obviously has tens of thousands of warehouse and fulfillment and delivery workers who have definite blue collar work conditions and pay. And, you know, Facebook has, you know, third party contractors to do their platform moderating. And those people have, you know, Wall Street Journal called it the worst job in technology because it's, you're getting paid, you know, 15 to 20 bucks an hour, maybe, with no job security. And your whole job is just continuously for your shift viewing the most nightmarish shit that people put on YouTube or Facebook, and you're just watching it. You're watching a child army getting killed or a Islamic beheading or a murder that someone's uploaded, and you're like, okay, delete that, take that off the platform, and now the next one. Like, can you imagine working that job? So there's a white and blue collar component to these workforces to be organized. I mean, that might be obvious. But the other thing I point out is that in these platforms, like, a lot of the work, like a lot of the value creation is done by us, the platform users. Like, we're the ones who make the Facebook posts. We're the ones who upload the YouTube videos. We're the ones who create websites for Google to organize and index. And we make applications to run on phones and so on. So we users are part of that workforce, so we need to be helping in that organizing effort ourselves. And exactly what that would look like, you know, a lot of people are talking about that. You know, obviously tech industry is so important, people have a lot of eyes on it right now, but we should be thinking about how we can come together and organize ourselves and help these workers organize and support them when they want to do that. Like, that would be steps toward a real online socialism where we socialize these platforms rather than getting a software update on your phone that says, click that you accept the terms of service and we'll update the phone. If you ever click through and look at those terms of service, it's an insane amount of unreadable technical legalese, you know? that's their power, though. Like, that's where they say, here's the new rules for what we can do on your phone and what you can do. And most of us just go, ugh, I wouldn't understand this. I might as well accept it. We should be writing those fucking terms of service. So that's the type of thing that we should be striving to do with a online socialism, is reach a point where we users are organized and where we're coordinating with organized workers who operate those actual platforms, where we can use that to take them over and operate them on our own terms. And then we decide what the terms of service are and where we may be tracked and where our data is used. We would be making that decision rather than some entities that have Wall Street profit targets to meet every quarter.
Well, you know, Rob, I have to thank you not only for coming on the show, but for writing this book, Bit Tyrants. I'm adding it to my collection of books on big tech. There's so many great voices out there. You mentioned Yasha Levine. There's Corey Pine. There's David Galumbia. I think Repeater Books has a new book coming out called Abolish Silicon Valley.
Yes, Wendy Liu's new book, and she's the real deal, too. Like, she actually comes from tech.
She's an insider, yeah.
Yes, that's right. I'm looking forward to that book as well. We were supposed to do an event in San Francisco last week, which, of course, is delayed at this point. But, yeah, I feel good to be part of a wave of leftist or independent writers who are looking at these firms. It's too big for one person to take on by themselves. So it's a very favorable thing, and I think her book's more about, like, how Silicon Valley as a whole system works and looks more at like all the startups and the private equity and how that process all works. And it's fascinating. I read a lot about it. In my book, I try to focus on the biggest guys and why the economics of why they have their monopolies and then why they're such scumbags as CEOs. But yeah, Corey Pine's book about like trying to work and hustle your way through the Silicon Valley workplace. I forget his book's name, but it's very good. A lot of good literature on
work,
this.
Work, die. I think.
Yes, it's a funny name. I couldn't remember it. People should check these books out, man. Like, these are the firms that we are relying on now for every damn thing we do. And they're as big as it gets. These are trillion-dollar firms. We never had those before. So people should, we're stuck at home. Never going to be a better time to catch up on your reading than right now. So, yeah, please pick up these books. They're good stuff.
Well, I was just saying that I think it's a silver lining, because if you guys are all speaking out, we have multiple voices, it means that, like in the era of Upton Sinclair, when he was speaking out against the meat factories and, the oil companies, you had all these great muckrakers pointing out, hey, this is BS, this gilded age that we're living in. This means that we're already seeing the pushback against the new Gilded Age. And I think that's the silver lining in all of this. Rob, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Everyone check out Bit Tyrants, the political economy of Silicon Valley.
Right on. Thanks, man. My pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Rob Larson. Please be sure to check out the book, Bit Tyrants, The Political Economy of Silicon Valley. And hey, if you can, even pick up Capitalism vs. Freedom, The Toll Road to Serfdom. Really great books. Hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you want to drop me a line with your thoughts about this edition of Parallax Views, please feel free to do so on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. I know times are tough, but I do this show for a living, and I need your support. So if you can, and only if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And of course, if you do sign up for the $5 tier, you get a bit of bonus content each month, including shows with my co-host Casey and I, just sort of shooting the proverbial poop so to speak. And video interviews, bonus shows, all kinds of good content, and past editions of Parallax Views that are now in the archives. I recently had a listener ask, why are some of the shows not available anymore? And it's because I've had to put those shows in the archive. I really need to do that to get Patreon support. Now, if I could, I'd release everything for free, but until we can get that model working in the world, I'm gonna have to put some of the older shows behind a paywall. It's not something I like doing, but as I said, this is a full-time endeavor, and it is, for me, the best way to keep this program going full-time. So if you can, please support me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.